Hello, and welcome to the Thinking Elixir podcast, where we cover the news of the community and learn from each other. My name is Mark Erickson.
I'm Cade Ward.
And I'm David Bernheisel.
Let's jump into the news. First up, OTP 27.0 RC2 was released. So this is the new OTP version that includes the JSON module. As a reminder, the JSON module was proposed and implemented by Michał Muscala, the creator of the JSON library in Elixir, and the JSON app. You know, that's going to be forever difficult to like distinguish JSON and JSON. We'll do our best. So the JSON app in OTP is faster, and the JSON library will be updated to use it to assist with transitioning to OTP 27 as it becomes available. And so you don't even have to do much to your Elixir code, maybe nothing at all. And you'll just be able to get some of those benefits. So as a reminder, RC1 included the update to leverage the documentation EEP, which means that OTP supports XDoc. I don't know if they're going to be republishing all of the docs on the Erlang website, you know, using XDoc, or if this is just maybe libraries that people are using or application or internal stuff.
No. This is all about the OTP docs themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the PR back before they had merged it, like it included like a demo site of it while the PR was going. Since the PR has been merged though, like that demo site isn't here anymore. So we'll have to wait until it actually releases.
Can't see the progress. Yeah.
Yeah. Each OTP app though has like its own XDoc style docs. So I think that isn't the intention. I don't want to misspeak, but I think the intention is, yeah, all the OTP docs will be republished using the XDoc style like documentation. What's unclear to me is whether or not that will be posted to hex docs.
Yeah.
You still may not be able to like do the hex docs search. So that part we haven't clarified. Would be nifty though.
Oh yeah.
It's fun to think about XDoc because like sometimes you don't, it's so coupled with hex to me, you know, like that's just part of the process of publishing to hex. But it doesn't have to be, you know, XDoc could just give you statically compiled stuff. Mm-hmm. It could use your own styles. It doesn't even have to use the built-in stuff. Like XDoc is quite flexible and nice. And so I suspect the OTP team is leveraging like just the XDoc stuff and not so much the hex docs stuff. You mentioning JSON and JSON, there's XDoc and HexDoc also. You know, we got these words that just sound too close together. Well, moving on. Phoenix Live Reload, we talked about it last week, gains an update and a blog post. It's gained the update in the past couple of weeks, but a blog post is the most recent thing. Chris McCord wrote a blog post. It's published on VIO's Phoenix Files, and it just goes into more detail and more history of what the Live Reload update is doing. And for those that haven't listened to the recent updates, Phoenix Live Reload was updated. It's one of these dev-only tools, and the idea is that it will live reload your assets while you're developing. So that way, you're not constantly, you know, Command-R, Control-R, you know, your browser, that kind of stuff, if you're working on a web app. The new update allows your server logs to be printed to the JavaScript console. So that way, you can see, like, for example, if you're developing a live view, your live view crashes, you'd be constantly tabbing over to your server console and then your browser to see new changes, what happens, what's the behavior like, all that kind of stuff. So just as an effort to keep you in the browser, you can now see your server logs in your browser console. So that way you don't have to tab as much. Also included in here in the update, but not mentioned in the blog post, is the ability to open up your editor to like specific Heex templates. So that way it's easier to find where, you know, a template is being rendered from, so you can adjust styles, that kind of stuff, much more easily. Like all dev-only dependencies, I mean, it's in the name, dev-only dependencies. Mm-hmm. Like there's several controls around that, but it's probably worth mentioning that you definitely don't want your server logs posting to your production site. Yep. For various reasons. One including, you know, like if your live view crashes and somehow has a sensitive secret in it that now gets streamed to all of your users, you don't want that to happen. But there's several mistakes to get to that point, but it's worth just reiterating. If you are updating Phoenix Live Reload, you probably want to also double check that it is most definitely beyond a certain doubt, you know, like that it is only development, which kind of got me thinking, like, our JavaScript with LiveView and Phoenix and stuff, like it's all the templates are just like, hey, here's your app.js and here's your Phoenix LiveView hooks. Here's your CSRF token stuff. Init a couple things. Here's your top bar. But now we have like a dev-only JavaScript thing. You have to also add the event handler on the JavaScript side to handle those streaming server-side logs, which kind of got me thinking, like, we haven't really had like a dev-only JavaScript side, you know? Like,
right.
How could you just give yourself another safeguard or only have logic that is present in development? So I'm certain there's a way to do it, but maybe the generators should have like a new pattern for this kind of stuff that's like app.dev.js and app.prod.js or something like that. I don't know.
What I would hate about that is the idea of, oh, my hook is working on my computer, but when I deploy it, it's not, you know, because we're accidentally putting stuff, you know, active development stuff in like the dev.js and it's not in the prod, but then you need like this is the general runtime one that's not specific to either. Yeah, so we don't have a good solution there. But with the Phoenix Live Reload, I did want to point out that, you know, if you copy paste and follow the instructions, just copy paste, right? You're getting it right.
Yeah.
But if someone really wanted to do a nasty troll, they could say, here's how you add all of this to your application, and they do all of it wrong, where instead of config dev EXS, they're putting it in prod, and instead of Phoenix Live Reload only dev, then they're, you know, it's general available. It's like, so just, you know, make sure you trust the source you're getting your instructions from.
Yeah. And if those instructions tell you to save by pressing Alt F4, you definitely know they're trolling you. This is throwing me back to Rails days where you'd have .js.erb files.
You could do template replacement in your JS.
Yeah. Yeah. So like I've mentioned it. So now I've stroked the memories of trolls, you know, to start implementing that kind of stuff on the Elixir side. I don't think I want app.js.eex and have like an even more complicated ASIF pipeline. That was like one thing that like ES Build brought to us was a simpler ASIF pipeline. I don't want to add another step to interpolate, but that would be a way, you know, to like kind of pre-process your JavaScript to only include these things in dev when mix env, you know, equals dev, do these live reload things and also enable latency simulation or something like that, you know. Oof. Well, Phoenix Live Reload, one of those libraries you never think about, but every once in a while gets a 10-minute conversation on your favorite podcast.
I'm grateful that Chris McCord's thinking about it and doing some fun stuff and giving us some new developer experience tools. So that's awesome. Well, moving on, Oben Pro 1.4.0 was released. So this is the pro version that you have to be a subscriber for. We just wanted to highlight some of the new features, and one of those is streamlined workflows. Workflows now use automatic scheduling to run workflow jobs in order without any polling or snoozing. Jobs with upstream dependencies are automatically marked as on hold and scheduled far into the future. Another feature is the job execution deadlines. So jobs that shouldn't run after some period of time can be marked with a deadline, you know, saying if you haven't run by this time, just don't run, you know, because maybe something else has happened and it's irrelevant now. So after the deadline is passed, the job will be preemptively canceled on its next run or optionally during its next run if desired. So very nice.
All right. Came across a PSA for logger users, which is probably most Elixir devs, right? So at Elixir Fun posted kind of a horror story, I guess. What did not realize that it would do this. I mean, it makes sense when you think about it, but oh man, I feel for him. But so he says, note to self, never pipe into logger like this, as the whole pipe might be compiled out of the code. And so the code example is like URL pipe into tesla.post pipe into logger info. You know, like I just want to log the output of the request. It's reasonable, right? But all that being that one expression, that one pipeline expression, in prod, sometimes you might have compile time purge turned on for logger statements. So if you're not logging the info level or something, and you're only logging like warning and error, that whole expression might be purged from your code. And so you'll never actually, in his example, you'll never actually tesla.post. Your request won't actually go. That was probably a nasty surprise. So yeah, just a reminder that logger has configuration to optimize itself And the way it optimizes itself is by removing all the expressions below certain matches. And the matches can be on the locker level. It can be on specific modules. It can be on specific functions. You can say, don't lock anything in this whole module, which is kind of cool. Didn't realize you could do that until I looked at the docs. I thought it was just level only, but you can customize it even further. If this is interesting to you, there's also an interesting forum post that illustrates how Logger is actually, they have a clickbait title, logging, a silent performance killer. And it does affect, you know, performance. So there's truth to that. But if you want to read more about how much it can affect your performance, especially if you're doing a lot of low level stuff, file reading, that kind of stuff, check out the forum post. It's an oldie, but a goodie.
And next up, we wanted to share that Andreas Alejos shared his template for smart cells that includes support for bundling with Vite.js and styling with Tailwind CSS. So it's a Kino smart cell template. So if you're wanting to start playing with some of these Kino smart cells and you want to step up and not be starting from ground zero, and you want to be able to just pull in, like, how do I do this? I want to have some visualizations and I really want it to look nice, you know, so I want some Tailwind stuff because I'm already familiar with how to do the CSS classes on that. It's a great option to check that out and see if that can give you the leverage you need.
Always love me some live book stuff.
Fly.io. It's a great place to run Elixir apps. With many global regions, a private network that makes it easy to cluster your app, and a powerful CLI, it's something you should really try out. Experience it for yourself at fly.io.
All right, next up, Elixir gained a simple setup library for getting a LiveView server running. Especially cool for these like quick little examples, like these little mix install things that are kind of nifty, you know, like run this on your computer and see what your performance is like or something along those lines. I've seen LiveView being set up in one file, but it still can be like 400 lines long or 300 lines long. So there's a library here called LiveView Playgrounds that's new. This is the new part. Not official library or anything, but a very cool library in that it takes away a lot of that boilerplate. So that way you can, the example kind of speaks for itself, but you just mix install this LiveView playground. You def module your LiveView. You use the LiveView playground. You define your mounts, your render, and then you LiveView playground.start. And that's kind of it. And then you just, you know, execute your EXS script there. So like in your console, you say elixir main.exs and you're done. That's kind of it. So it just removes a lot of that boilerplate, which is kind of nifty. And side benefit, it works in Livebook too. So you can mix this all that into your Livebook and have a LiveView server running right in there. And you'll see all the logs print out in your Livebook. Very nifty. Good way to like prototype a thing without doing a lot of toil and yak shaving to get something up and running.
And next up, the team of researchers who built a catalog of anti-patterns and code smells for Elixir, well, they are back at it, and they're working on a catalog of code refactorings, and they are asking for community feedback and input. So we have some links in the show notes where you can find it. The academics behind this said, if you are an Elixir developer and are interested in the quality of your code, could you please help us by answering this survey on refactorings? And just as a heads up, they estimated it would take about 20 minutes of time. If you've checked out like the code smells and the anti-patterns and you're like, oh, these are cool, or I wish they would have included this one, you know, then you should probably go check this out and see if you can share some of the refactorings that you find most valuable too.
I took it. I don't think it takes a full 20 minutes, but it could if you're totally unfamiliar with all the patterns that they have in there, which, by the way, they've got a ton of patterns in there. Things that have names that I didn't realize had names. So that's good. And so if you looked at it like a year ago, you should look at it again because it's a lot more than it was. So it didn't stay still. All right. Well, last up, not Elixir specific, but probably affecting some Elixir apps out there that use Redis. Redis is no longer free software. Womp womp. We got an article that goes into detail about what's going on, but the gist of it is that the Redis in-memory database system had its license changed to either Redis source available or server-side public release. Neither license qualifies as free software. And so here's a quote. Under the new license, cloud service providers hosting Redis offerings will no longer be permitted to use the source code of Redis free of charge. For example, cloud service providers will be able to deliver Redis 7.4 only after agreeing to licensing terms with Redis, the maintainers of the Redis code. You can imagine the implications of all this, but one implication is that distributors of Linux, this flavor being Fedora, they're already looking at removing Redis from their repository. So it makes sense. It's not really free software. And so the Linux world is definitely going to have to take notice. It also might imply that some service providers that you may or may not have been using may have to adjust their billing for you now.
Or they're just not going to be giving the latest versions of Redis anymore. They'll be kind of stuck on the pre-7.4.
Yeah.
I found this interesting article on the Momento website, which I think, from what I gathered, it looks like they might offer a competing product. So, you know, it's got some flavor there, a little spice. But it has a lot of deeper reporting on the history of the Redis project, which I found very interesting. So the Redis database was not actually created by Redis Labs, the company. It was created by Salvatore Sanfilippo. Hopefully I got that name somewhere close. The company at the time was called Garantia Data. They made an early bid to try and co-opt the trademark and name by changing their name to be Redis. The creator, you know, fought back and they stopped that. So Garantia Data then later changed their name to Redis Labs. And so that's where the Redis Labs comes from. They had nothing to do with the creation of Redis. So then in 2015, Redis Labs, you know, Garantia Data by a different name now, they hired Antires, which is the Salvatore Sanfilippo original developer, and Redis Labs became the official sponsor of the Redis open source project. Eventually, the developer chose to step away from the project in 2020, and he transferred the IP and trademarks to Redis Labs, or, you know, Garantia Data, which is why they now have the legal rights to relicense the project. So Redis didn't create Redis, but now they own it through some interesting, you know, maybe a slightly gray past there. But this decision, we have yet to see exactly how it's going to play out and impact the broader community, because Redis is just so broadly used. I've worked in companies where, you know, if it's Ruby on Rails, like, it's a go-to. It's just almost an assumption that you're going to have Redis there. It used to be Memcache, but then it became Redis. Like, that was like, you assume it's there. And then when we were doing something with like Phoenix systems and Ruby on Rails, then Redis was our way of transferring state between them when we needing to hand off things to different parts of the application. So yeah, it is going to impact, you know, even us in the Electric community who don't necessarily need an in-memory cache data store, because Phoenix and Elixir can do a lot of that for us. But, you know, still, it plays a valuable role, just because if I have four Phoenix servers and I want to have a Redis server to share state that way, I can, and people still do.
Yeah, and Redis is used as more than just a cache as well, right? Etz and Redis have a lot of overlap in applications and how to use it. So Etz can replace a lot of that simple usage of what you might be using Redis for. But Redis also has additional powers on top of that.
Oh, yeah. Some people use it for doing PubSub. If you're using Phoenix, you don't need it to do PubSub for you, but like other libraries and frameworks will use that. So yeah, it can do a lot. Yeah, it's powerful.
It's a way around setting up a cluster too, if you just didn't want to do that and you already had Redis, for example. Anyway, I am not surprised, because this is how software has been going for a long time. So yeah, I get it. But if you're also insisting on its open source roots, which is, you know, according to the history there, like, yeah, it started out that way. It continues that way. There's still a good following for it to be an open source project. You might be pleased to know that there is a fork, or rather it's being posited as Redis is now the fork. And the original is now called Redict. Re as in remote dictionary. Andrew Kelly is the creator of Zig, and he has a blog post that kind of illustrates his point here, but I can't not say it, but Redict is forking Redis at 7.3, or whatever one was the last release for the open source license, will continue developing separately. If you still need to have some open source software, it's not quite the end. There isn't another option. Now, time will tell if Redict is maintained, worthy, reliable, all that kind of stuff. Who knows at this point, but there is an option forward, at least, for continuing on in an open source license.
It might be like how MySQL became MariaDB, you know, in terms of the open source version that people are using for a lot of, you know, Linux distributions and stuff.
Right. And you know what? Like, I am not a Redis power user. but quite literally, when I come into companies like as a new employee, they're like running like Redis 2, you know, like Redis 3. The stuff is just so reliable and not needed for maintenance. Like, it really is kind of like a deploy and forget kind of thing.
And if you're not using any of the newer features, that you're not looking for those, you're just, it's fine.
Yeah, like, if they absolutely need the money to supply, to, you know, to pay developers to continue working on Redis and introduce, like, a ton of new amazing features or something that it doesn't do already and can gain those users to, like, leverage those new things, like, I guess, go for it, but... I love Redis because it's just for one of those things in your infrastructure. It's just so easy and drama free is the other part. Like I've never really have problems with Redis. It's great. I also use it almost entirely as an ephemeral cache.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're not persisting.
Yeah. When it goes down, like, I don't care. Like it'll rebuild and I'll be fine. I can't say the same about Postgres. You know, I definitely need some stability there. That can't just be deleted and everyone be okay. But Redis, I guess the attitude towards it is just a lot more forgiving, a lot more meh, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. We'll see what happens. But yeah, topic Redis is no longer free software. It's, I'm sure, going to make some waves for a little bit.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you'll join us next time on Thinking Elixir.